Create more. Share more. Live more. This is the Bucket List Life.
Welcome to the Bucket List Life, episode 47. This podcast series has been getting rave reviews across the board. We've been seeing awesome written reviews on iTunes, and we're getting five-star ratings across the board. Why is this? Because we bring you the most wonderful and awesome and exciting guests from around the globe. But additionally, it happens because of you, the listeners. We're very thankful to you because you go to thebucketlistlife.com, you click join, and you've joined our Facebook group page where we have over 1,000 people there celebrating, supporting, helping people share life's experiences. And that's what this is really about, helping others and sharing in life's experiences. And today, we're going to learn about some experiences from a gentleman who is an author and an adventurer. This is somebody who's an author of 4 books. Also, he's a naturalist, a guest speaker with the Princess Cruises in Alaska. He's a globetrotter, an edgewalker, and this other thing that I just found out, that he's appeared not once, but twice on the Oprah Winfrey Show. But you know, when he's not writing books or hosting adventure travel TV shows or giving motivational speeches around the world, he also enjoys exploring the Alaskan fjords and leading walking safaris in Tanzania, Africa. So I want to bring to the podcast today, all the way from Florida, and that is Michael Mojoleski.
Kenyon, how are you, man?
Hey, this is so cool. You know, I just met you. You know, we've been chatting via email and conversing. I've been looking up your stuff online and getting basically entrenched in your adventures and all that you've done. It seems like you've been doing adventures for a long time. So without giving away your age, how long have you been living this adventurous life?
By the way, I want to thank you for having me on. It's an absolute honor, and congratulations on the success of your show.
Well, thank you so much. We couldn't think of a better fit than having you on board with this podcast. So I'm looking forward to learning so much.
I've probably been doing this crazy stuff in it, let's say 40 years. And it all started with my mother. She read me to sleep every single night when I was like 6, 7 years old. And she said that she would keep reading when my eyes were closed and my chest was moving up and down. In other words, when I was asleep. And I think it's been proven by people that are teaching themselves foreign languages. If you let the tape run all night, I think the subconscious never sleeps and we still absorb information. So she'd read me those great classic books like, you know, Ivanhoe, Grimm's Fairy Tales, Moby Dick. And one night she read me Call of the Wild by Jack London. Now, at that young age, I don't know why that particular book resonated so much, but the rest of my life, I was in search of wilderness. And I was a ski bum, graduated from Indiana University, journalism degree, and I'm out in Aspen, Colorado, skiing for a year. And they had a film revival of sort of Western and mountain man movies, local to sort of the Rocky Mountains. And I saw this movie by Robert Redford called Jeremiah Johnson, where this guy in the 1880s doesn't know a thing, goes up and tries to survive as a mountain man and learn from the natives. I came out of that movie saying, is there a place on earth today in our modern times where you can have those same experiences? Be careful what you ask for. You just might get it.
Well, it seems that for you, 4 decades of traveling adventure, that you've acquired some stories and some experiences. And the Bucket List Life, as I mentioned, is about sharing life's experiences. So for you, what are some of the things that you have really just grabbed a hold of, like really are still near and dear to your heart? Do you have an example?
Well, you know, Socrates, in all of his wisdom, he said to know thyself. And it's so true that we can't really love anybody outside of ourselves unless we have the first, we have the love inside. And I really believe in a saying that, we attract what we are, that what levels we are internally, we manifest that externally. And so I could see life coming very fast. you know, the treadmill of life, marriage, mortgage, kids. And I wanted to slow it down because I felt like I wasn't learning enough about myself. And with Jack London and Jeremiah Johnson as sort of catalysts, I wanted to take this retreat deep into nature where I could be sort of Thoreau at Walden Pond as well, have time to figure out who the heck I was before I was going to make any contribution to society. And, you know, I'm learning that there's no accidents in life. Here I am, ski bum, living in Aspen, Colorado. I volunteered at the Aspen Design Conference that they have every summer. Designers fly in from all over the world. And I was just, you know, freelance journalist, just starving to death between assignments. So I volunteered to put up the tents for a free ticket. So I get into the conference, and the second day they announce, hey, everybody take a lunch break, go out in the meadow. We're going to watch hang gliders come off the top of Ajax Mountain. They're going to land at your feet. So there's 1,000 people in this meadow, 7,000 feet up. And we're all staggering around with our heads back, watching these human kites spiraling down off the mountain. And I bumped into a back. But why didn't I bump the back to the left or the back to the right? I bumped into a woman. I fell in love with her. She was an architect from Vancouver, British Columbia. I had never been west of Colorado. I hitchhiked to California, all the way up the West Coast, sticking my thumb out. And I spent 2 weeks with Genevieve in her sailboat, going up the most beautiful geographical area in the world called the Inside Passage, 1,000 miles from Puget Sound up to Glacier Bay, Alaska, full of islands, snow-capped mountains, ocean full of killer whales, bears everywhere. And I didn't even know that place existed. The night before I was due to leave Genevieve to go back to Colorado, the phone rang. And it's a man that owned a wilderness island. And he wanted to take Genevieve out for dinner. And how many guys are going to do this? Genevieve says, Will, I remember you. I'll have to do it another time because I have company. Michael's here. And Will goes, okay, the three of us will go out. I mean, that's pretty rare that, you know, a guy would allow another guy to tag along. The three of us went out. Genevieve was ignored. Will Maloff had what I wanted. He had wilderness. He just had beauty. And I was sort of writer in search of my first book. You know, I had written a lot of journalism, and I wanted to write that first book. He had what I wanted. He had Jack London, Jeremiah Johnson. So he was in a hurry, and he said, hey, I'm giving you a formal invitation. My island is 200 miles north and 100 years back in time. You're invited to come. Will left. Fortune cookies came. It was a Chinese food dinner. And I opened my cookie, and it said, you're going on a journey to an exotic land. I mean, do you need a hammer to hit you over the head? It's like, pay attention here.
Wow. It's so crazy that just simply volunteering for one thing, how that changed everything in the course of your direction, that you were just out in that field and you bumped into the woman that you fell in love with. And this type of storyline, it really can't be written, can it?
Kenyon, I really believe, yeah, and you're so right. You can't make this stuff up. That's why I call it La Vida Loca. That's sort of the subtitle of my life, the crazy life. But I really believe there are angels on earth. They might not have wings on their back, but people come into our lives as emissaries or connectors. Maybe they put us on a job path, a career. Maybe they introduce us to a spouse. You know, they're right under our nose, sort of hidden in plain sight. And of course, I couldn't continue my relationship with Genevieve when I went to the island because she was so far away. But every New Year's Eve, I try to call her and thank her for giving me my life, for giving me my future. But why did I bump that back that day? Why wasn't I 12 inches to the left or to the right and I would have missed the connection?
Because that's not the path. It's almost in a sense that it was written.
Exactly.
And so you have this experience, and it really is something that I bet that you've shared that story hundreds, if not thousands of times.
Well, I'm so privileged now. I still go back to the island from time to time. I kind of pick my moments because I know when the killer whales are there, you know, chasing herring in the spring. And, you know, I pick my moments when I go back. But the real thrill to me is to now share it with people from around the world. Because Princess Cruises, goes up from Vancouver and Seattle all the way up to Glacier Bay. And it's so weird being on the cruise ship going right by the island that I lived on. So I'm able to do PowerPoint programs, show pictures, share the stories of what it's like to live out there. And it's so cool to lecture with people seeing in real time out the windows and on their own shore adventures what you're talking about. And it's a great gig as an author, because if you're an Amazon, you're one of 7 million books. But if you have a captive audience of 3,000 passengers every week times 20 weeks in the summer, you know, that just gobble up anything you've written because they want to learn about that place because it's so multidimensional.
I've never been to Alaska, and out of the 50 states, I've been to 49 of them, and Alaska is the one I'm missing. So I always hear of its beauty and just how amazing and remarkable it is to see these fjords. Can you just take me through that as if I was on the boat? Like, what would I see if I was going up through that part of Alaska?
Well, I have two favorite places in the world. One you mentioned in the intro, the lead-in, and that's the Ngorongoro Crater in Tanzania, where we do walking safaris. And my second other place is a place called Tracy Arm Fjord, and it's 50 miles south of Juneau, and it's a glacier-carved masterpiece. It's 26 miles long. It's no wider than 200 yards across from one mountain wall to the other. You've got these granite rock cliffs going up 7,000 feet vertical out of ocean that is 1,000 feet deep right against the base of those mountains. So there's no shelving there. There's no beaches. Like here in Florida, you can walk out 200 yards in a beach and you're up to water just up to your waist. But there, the water falls right down 1,000 feet against the land, and it's serpentine. It's never a straight line. You're constantly twisting and turning. So it slowly reveals its magic. You've got waterfalls that are 2,000 feet that you can track. You've got hummingbirds in the summer pollinating wildflowers that grow. I mean, these bushes and trees that can grow out of that vertical rock with a taproot that can split rock to get enough nutrients. They pump out these wildflowers that the hummingbirds come all the way up from Mexico, 3,000 miles, a bird that small, to pollinate those wildflowers in Tracy Arm. And then you get to the end of the fjord, and you have a glacier that's 20 miles long, 1,000 feet thick, and it's at the face where the ice comes down to the ocean. It's 250 feet tall. So you're looking at a 25-story building of sapphire blue ice. It's calving icebergs that are as big as houses. The sound the natives call white thunder, it reverberates through your soul. And to see that ice smacking that water just a couple hundred yards in front of you from the cruise ship, I mean, it's a spiritual experience. People cry. It's like that color blue paints their soul. It's transformative up there. In fact, a Buddhist monk last summer, we had just come out of Tracy Arm, and it was showing off its greatest hits. You know, where else in the world can you see a hummingbird and a, you know, an iceberg that weighs 500 tons and then a humpback whale on the way out of the fjord? You know, it just gives you so much life and vitality up there. And this Buddhist monk goes, "Michael, that place is the culmination of my religion, the Tao, T-A-O. He says, it's yin and yang together, perfect balance. Harmony between opposites. You have the feminine principle, the fluid ocean. You have male principle, stalwart rock mountain. When you put yin and yang, you put opposite elements together, it produces beauty and tranquility." And it's just amazing what people have no idea what's up there, and they go home crying.
You pretty much answered the question that came to mind for me, because I'm sitting here listening to you tell and share this experience. And while it's impossible for me to know exactly, I do have an insight to what it must be like to travel up those fjords. And for a lot of things, when people have experiences, and they have these experiences that are shared, where you're sharing your insights while they're traveling up these fjords and they're understanding this from the things that you share during your speaking engagements on these cruises, you must see this transformation happen for these people from the first day they step on the boat until the day they step off the boat. What's that transformation like?
Oh, you know, I have seen it probably more intensely, and you just nailed it on the head. Probably in the last 8 years, as our technology and our smartphones have gotten so addictive, you know, the joke about Crackberry. So everybody comes on the ship, and the first day when we leave Seattle on this particular itinerary that I do, we're at sea. We're way out there off the coast, about 20 miles. So there's no cell phone signal. And you actually see people walking around jonesing to turn on their phone and, you know, to send their 500 texts if they're a teenage girl or to check Facebook 150 times. You could still use your phone, but it goes off the ship satellite at about $12.50 a minute. So, you know, you don't want to be doing that. So everybody is slowly pulling away from civilization, all these devices that we're addicted to. And I would say by the middle of the week, after we go into the fjord, that's usually our Wednesday, what email, what cell phone, could somebody please tell me my name? Because Alaska is just, nature is more, man is less, it humbles you, it just puts all of life into perspective.
Man, that is a feeling that I would like to know. I would like to understand what that's like because I'm so connected because of everything that we do. And I understand that, like, oh, got to check my phone. It becomes the habit where, oh, I'm not doing anything. I better just check my phone. Just maybe somebody liked another photo of mine and that will make me feel better. And instead being out there where you have to be present.
Well, and the thing is our attention spans are so chopped up with technology. And I mean, multitasking is the buzzword for everybody. We're doing 27 things at once. But like when I was living on the island, it was very zen because you would, as musicians say, you play the center of the note. You're doing one thing at a time deliberately. Your breathing is slowing down. In fact, when I would wake up on the island in that isolation, my breath, the ocean against the beach, the wind in the trees, and the whales inhaling and exhaling, it was all one breath. So you're starting your day that way, linked up, breathing with the world around you. And it puts you into sort of that deep meditative state where we can do most of our deep thinking.
So through this process, did you end up finding yourself? Because that's what your goal was. It seems like you have.
Oh, and you know what, Kenyon, I really believe, and I was reading a book one day, and I had yet, my first winter, I went 67 straight days without seeing another human being. And I was just trying to survive out there because the weather, the storms in the wintertime and the inside passage are ferocious. It can blow about 80 miles an hour. The rain hits the windows of your little cabin like BB shot. And this doesn't happen like for one day. This will go on for weeks, these low-pressure systems coming out of the southeast. And one day, I'm sitting inside the tiny cabin, and I'm about 3 feet away from the airtight wood stove. It's chugging along, keeping me warm. And I'm sitting there at the kitchen table, and the wind was so strong, it got inverted down the stovepipe. It blew the lid off the stove, and through the air valve at the bottom, A tongue of flame shot out, set my chair on fire with me sitting in it. I mean, you literally feel like you're under attack from the elements. Gets dark up there about 4 in the afternoon. Sun doesn't come up till about 10, 11 a.m. So you're under assault. But those long winter nights, I would fire up the kerosene lamps, about 6 of them, make a ring, and read all these books that I had never had time for. But before I went, I knew nothing. You know, city slicker from Cleveland, Ohio. I was 40,000 leagues in over my head, nothing on my resume. And unlike the TV show Survivor, There was nobody else out there to vote you off and send you home. So 67 days over 2 months, I'm trying to hang on, trying to survive, learn from that wilderness, because it will seduce you with beauty. Alaska will. And then the next minute, it will try to kill you if you're not prepared. Jack London said there's 1,000 ways Alaska can kill a person. So I'm just learning, and I made a big mistake. I didn't talk. There was nobody to speak to, you know, and I should have mumbled like those old prospectors or whatever. So finally, there was a break in the storms. A little boat got tossed up onto the beach. Out of the boat stepped 5 full-blooded Kwakiutl Native men. They carved the magnificent totem poles up there. And the natives have never been conquered by the white man in British Columbia and Alaska, like in the lower 48. They've never been thrown away on a useless reservation. So these native people have their pride and their heritage intact. And they know that place better than the back of their hand because they've been there 10,000 years. So the native men came into the cabin and I couldn't talk. Because Ralph Emerson had a great line, the great writer philosopher. He said, I can't hear what you're saying because who you are thunders so loudly. But having human beings in front of me again, it's like I couldn't process the visual and the audio at the same time. I mean, we do that without even thinking. And when I did try to talk, I sounded like I was drunk because your tongue is like any other muscle. If you don't exercise it, the power of speech is going to wither away. So finally, the chief of the natives, Larry Joseph, he kept glancing over at that suitcase full of books that I had to read during those long winter nights. And he said, you white people, you're all the same. You have a head full of knowledge. You know all the facts. And then he pointed to his heart, but you have no wisdom. You're going to end up burning those books in your wood stove. Stood up. Single file out the doorway. Larry Joseph paused in the door frame, looked over his right shoulder, and he said, I'll be by in the spring to collect your bones. That was the welcoming committee, the Chamber of Commerce, but there was no fruit basket. So I'm not embarrassed to tell you this, but I was so shaken with fear, I collapsed into that kitchen chair and I flipped a page of a book. And, you know, a lot of times people will do that. They'll flip a book open looking for guidance and just stab their finger, you know, with their eyes closed and then read the sentence. This sentence came from a famous psychologist named William James. And it jumped off that page again, like one of those landmarks in life, and it saved me. William James wrote that we as human beings lead lives inferior to ourselves. We only live a tiny part of the colossal life and potential that we all possess. So that gave me confidence that maybe I could survive out there. So I kind of took it as a challenge to show the native people that maybe even a white guy that knew nothing could survive and eventually thrive in their world.
That is an unreal story. I just couldn't fathom doing 67 or even let's call it 27 days out in that type of environment. But at the same time, I have absolute respect for what you have completed and what you have done, and to live vicariously through that experience. The more that I listen to you, the more that I start to say, well, maybe there's a possibility I could do something like that. I could live that way. And as I continue to think, one of my favorite things is always to find ways to help others. And through your journeys and your adventures, how have you been able to reach out and help others from what you've learned or what you know or what you've experienced in your life?
Well, I've been so fortunate to be able to publish books and then to also be on stage with Princess, because the cruise is up there last 7 days. It's round trip out of Seattle for the itinerary I do. And each week, we get people from all 50 U.S. states and an average of 30 countries from around the world come to Alaska to see the beauty, to see the glaciers. I mean, South Africa, Mongolia, Israel, Jamaica. I mean, you name the country and people are there. So to be on that stage like a conduit, because I don't really feel it's me. It comes through me, not from me. And what I think it is my soul vibrates the highest in that yin-yang country, in Alaska. I think everybody has a geographical place on this globe where they feel most at home. And I don't know if I lived a past life there or I just resonate the highest there. That's where I high vibe, my soul energy. And I think people respond to that. But it feels like it's coming through me, not from me. That when you get into that level of love for something, when you have that passion and purpose, then people just resonate with you. And when you're on fire, like Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, said, his best advice was follow your bliss. And when you go after what lights you up and what gets you to jump out of bed in the morning, people have no choice but to get the closed doors out of your way.
So for you, as you continue down this path, there are a lot of things that you've done and a lot of things that you'll continue to do. I want to ask about some of the things you've done, because when Oprah was in her heyday, everybody was like, oh, I'd love to be on the Oprah show. That would be cool. It's a bucket list item. Now it's Ellen. Everybody's like, how do I get on the Ellen show? That's the new bucket list item. How did you end up on Oprah? Not once, but twice.
Well, here's the crazy thing. And this is why I just go, why me? In a good way. I'm on this island for 2 years. I'm paddling every day in my kayak to study killer whales. And I really believe there's another mind on this planet that may be equal to our own or may even surpass us. And that is the orca / killer whale. And, you know, 3/4 of this world, of the globe, is covered with salt water. I think it's exactly 71%. And so it really should be called planet Earth and not planet, or planet ocean rather, and not planet Earth. And killer whales are found in every ocean, and they are the top predator in the sea. They eat everything, and nothing can touch or kill a killer whale. They have sonar. It's amazing high sound. They can send it right through your skin, and they get a sonogram. They get echolocation back to their brains. They can measure your heart rate, your adrenaline. I mean, if we had that ability to sonar scan each other, there'd be no politicians. I mean, we wouldn't be able to lie to each other. When my wife says, does this dress make me look fat? I'd have to tell the truth, you know? I mean, they literally can see inside of you as far as emotional states. They're phenomenal creatures. So anyway, I'm out there studying the wildlife, writing my first book, and not knowing anything, the writing process about how you got to get an agent first and all that. Just crazy. Ignorance is bliss. I sent the manuscript to HarperCollins in New York City, which is one of the biggest publishers in the world. And again, one of those moments, an editor is walking by the slush pile, you know, manuscripts stacked up to the ceiling. He happened to be Polish. He saw my long Polish last name. He was taking an hour to have a sandwich lunch at his desk. He pulled the manuscript out, started reading it, didn't put it down. Long story short, HarperCollins ended up publishing my first book. Well, the head of public relations there was friends with Helen Gurley Brown, who really took Cosmopolitan magazine when it was nothing. And HGB, or Helen Gurley Brown, put it in 100 countries around the world, translated into 87 languages. It's the best-selling women's magazine in the world and on college campuses. So Janet's having lunch and says to Helen, hey, we have this new author, but the guy hasn't had a date in about 2 years, you know, because there's no females out in that isolated Alaska wilderness. And I don't know why, to this day, again, one of these turning points of your life, Helen Gurley Brown said, well, we're going to do something about Michael's lack of social life. Every month in that magazine, they have a bachelor, a single guy. They put his mug or his picture in there with an address, email, whatever to write to. And you get thousands of letters from women around the world. So I came back to do publicity for my book about living in the wilderness. And I went from famine to feast. 5,000 women wrote, you know, and it was every man's fantasy. So that's the subject of the latest book.
And the latest book that you've got going right now, The Misadventures of a Cosmo Bachelor, that's the tagline of the book called Wild Life. Let's dig into that. What's this book basically about?
Well, you know, I love titles that have double meanings, like Inside Passage describes a geographical place, but it also means the passage inside that you go through, the spiritual levels of being up there. And wildlife, one of my agents at the time who was very plugged into the book world, we were having lunch, and he said, "Dude, do you realize the opportunity you have? Sigmund Freud once asked, what do women really want? You got a shot at finding out. Why don't you approach just study these women like you study the wildlife in Alaska? Use the scientific method. Leave your emotions out of it." And of course, all that went out on the first date, you know. So I that's why the book has that meaning. I actually approach these women as if I were studying dolphins, you know, various animals in Alaska. And I even have each chapter heading with sort of the species genus, or identify different types of women and give them their Latin names and all of that. So it's a lot of fun, kind of raunchy, because the Cosmo girls are not nuns. You know, they're very adventurous. But, I mean, you could not make up the dates. They were just, you know, I wasn't getting any sleep. I wasn't getting any work done. It was like the master of the universe said, "Hey, kid, the door's open to the female candy shop. Go in, help yourself. The lids are off all the jars. You can sample as many flavors as you like for the rest of your life." I mean, what did I do to deserve that? It was absolutely crazy.
But like all things and metaphors in life, at first this seems like the best thing in the world. Did you end up learning something through the process?
Well, you know, you hit the nail on the head, because there's a chapter later in the book called Sugar Shock. And when you are eating tiramisu for every meal, you get to a point where, you know, the one night stands, the anonymous sex, all of that. I'm being a scientist, I crave substance. I have to learn something new every 15 minutes, or I get impatient, because I just want to maximize my potential here. And I want to try to go everywhere and know everything. I just have that lust, that drive, you know, to just try to acquire knowledge. And so I was tired of kind of being on the superficial surface with a lot of the dates, although some of them were quite, you know, beneficial knowledge-wise, that it got to a point where I had to do a few timeouts. And there was, I'll never forget, there was a beauty pageant winner from the American South named Kim. And at that point, I just really needed a break. She hunted me down, called me on the phone. She said, "Michael," in that honey dripping Southern accent that is so beguiling, you know, and charming to a man. And Kim said, "Michael, I just have to meet you." And I said, "Kim, what if I'm a serial killer?" Then she said, "Then I'll die happy." I mean, that's how crazy life was at that time.
Well, you would never remember you would never expect that your life would have been that way. And then it ended up being that way just because of a simple article posted in Cosmo. But again, it led you to writing this book and having these adventures and sharing the knowledge that you've acquired from these adventures, and some of them sounding just pretty nutty, but also eventually very taxing on you. So now you're through this experience. The book comes out. This is the book that also landed you on Oprah, right?
Yeah. In fact, Oprah tracked us down. And the first time we were on her show was in Chicago, stayed at the Drake Hotel downstairs, you know, in downtown rather. And it's so funny. And that's why I love your show, because it's conversational. It's not scripted. But when we did Oprah Winfrey, our main contact was a producer. And the producer came over to the hotel room and said, "Here's a list of 20 questions. Oprah's going to ask you one or two, or maybe more, depending, tomorrow when you're live in front of 400 million people around the world. But don't think about that." You know, you're going, "Oh my God, what if I freeze up?" And so I stayed up, Kenyon, all night memorizing my answers to the all 20 questions, like word perfect, word by word. And of course, when Oprah turned our way and the camera swung, she didn't ask a question from that list at all. She tears up the script and she just goes with her feelings, you know, a typical Oprah phrase. But that's what makes her so good. That's what makes you so good, is that you have that impromptu and the serendipity. You know, you are totally in the moment with your interview. But then it was nuts because I wore my Oprah Winfrey baseball cap when I would lead safaris into Africa. And just to show the fame of this woman, like especially when she was doing her own show, as you mentioned before, we would be in the middle of nowhere and Maasai warriors would come out of the bush shaking their spear, chorusing together after they saw the words on the top of my hat. Oh, bruh. Oh, bruh. I mean, more famous than God and probably has more money.
Absolutely. But she does so much with that money. She's able to give back in so many ways. You know, there's always that joke where she's like, and you get a school and you get a school and you get a school. Like she just gives stuff away all the time, right, to everybody in her audiences, because she realized for her, it was never about her. It was always giving back to others, letting others really revel in that, having others really be able to go to that place to feel that experience and some of even just a little bit of what she gets to experience, that she's able to pass that on. And it seems like you got the same thing where she gave you a little bit and then now you've got this experience where even all the way in Africa, people are like, wow, you were on the Oprah show, and I'm sure you told that story a bunch of times too.
Yeah, and you know, I really believe getting to know her a little bit, you know, when the camera was off, and Oprah Winfrey is one of the most highly evolved spirits on our planet. And I really believe she was put here for a purpose, given such a large platform, because I really believe she is a light worker. And that is coming out more and more, like in her programming. And she's one of the really important forces. In fact, one of the sayings that I learned with the native people up in the Inside Passage to Alaska, and Oprah is definitely proof, and it's very much a Zen thing as well, that when one becomes egoless, one then becomes everything. That when you're not just about self and self-interest, when then you don't stop at your skin. You radiate outward with compassion and kindness into everything. And then you literally are the world. You feel that cosmic connection. But I think we all go through stages. Maybe when we're in our 20s, it's all about me. You know, it's just the world is tilted toward the self. But then when you go through another decade or another one, I think you begin to see that the greatest happiness in this life is to the little bit that we give, we get back 100-fold. But the feeling of giving unconditionally and without even knowing anybody knowing your name, you can't buy that feeling. That's the best feeling on earth.
How are you doing that now? How are you giving? And
well, financially, I give a percentage of all my books, my speaking fees to the World Wildlife Fund, because I've researched all the charitable organizations. And I think as we learned after 9/11, a lot of times our money doesn't go to the cause, but it goes to buy office furniture or pay somebody's Porsche payment. But with WWF, World Wildlife Fund, the money doesn't go to administration. I mean, they just take a bare bones salary to operate an office, but it goes to save the rhinos, save the elephants. That money is going directly to the ground, to ground level. So financially, I try to do that. And I just, when I'm on that ship in the summertime, I open up my heart and I'm just available. I will stand at the book table I have after my programs for 5 or 6 hours. But it's not work. When you're living your passion, those 6 hours of answering questions and giving people advice for their tours, it energizes me. And the 6 hours go by like 6 minutes. And I think when you're living your passion, you get outside the time-space continuum. And you really learn that there is no such thing as time. You know, some Roman Caesar decided there'd be 365 days in a year, and then there'd be another strike against us. But it's so arbitrary. Why not 700 days? Why not 7,000 to make up a year? You know, I know 90-year-olds that are 18 with their energy, and I know 18-year-olds, you might as well put them in the ground. They're 90. So bust the clocks. Forget that stuff.
Yeah, time is only made up. Just live your life, live in the now, and have every moment mean something, because you can never get it back. And I'm constantly thinking about that, constantly thinking about the fact that none of us, nobody on the planet, has the knowledge to know if they have a tomorrow. But so many of us just push off till tomorrow. They say, hey, you know what? I'm going to do that next week, next month, next year. And maybe they never get to do it. And maybe they stay alive the whole time. Or maybe they never get to do it because they've passed away in between that time. And so the way I look at it is, well, you've only got this moment and now. So take full advantage of it. And speaking of that, I was thinking about the time that I went on a safari in South Africa, and I'm thinking about you leading these safaris, and the guy that I had a gun just to protect us from the potential of lions and stuff like that. Is that what you were doing in Tanzania?
Yeah, we go usually in between the short rains and the long rains, and I love to go to Tanzania because everybody goes to Kenya, and if there's a lion, there's 22 Land Rovers encircling it. So you can barely take a picture of a lion without getting a bumper or a chrome, you know, in your shot. Tanzania is a little harder to get to travel-wise, but it's much wilder. There's less people out there. But Kenyan, draw a 100-mile circle. And within that circle, you've got the Serengeti Plains, where they have these millions of animals that are migrating. You've got Mount Kilimanjaro, 19,000 feet, tallest mountain in Africa with still glaciers and snow on top. You've got the Olduvai Gorge, where the Leakeys discovered all of the hominid bones. And then you have my other favorite place in the world, the Ngorongoro Crater, all within that 100-mile radius. So it is just a nature paradise. But our guide in the last 10 years with a gun has only had to shoot one animal that was endangering us. And just a trivia question, this animal kills. It's not a mosquito. The malarial mosquitoes actually kill more people. But what animal in Africa do you think kills more people there than any other?
Hippos.
You got it, man. You know.
I just saw a video on YouTube of this hippo charging through the water, and it was immensely fast.
Yeah, you know, they're so big and blubbery on land, but when they're in water, unbelievable. And you know those saber teeth, like everybody I think has been to the zoo and you see a hippo yawning or opening its mouth. They have these teeth on the bottom that stick up like swords, like for a foot and a half. So what often happens is a native wants to cross a river or stream, they build this little flimsy raft. Hey, it looks like calm water. I don't see any danger or, you know, alligators or anything. They get halfway across, and the hippos are so territorial that they come and they bite the guy right in half.
Is that why they're so temperamental? It has to do with their territory?
Yeah, they just, you know, this is my turf, and you do not intrude.
Offline, you mentioned something about wrestling alligators. I've done that too. We have that in common. I want to know about your experience.
Well, when I'm down here in Florida, I'm in and out in the wintertime. We go out in the Everglades, and a lot of times they'll do an alligator count in a survey. And sometimes we'll pick up ones that are injured when the bull alligators are fighting each other, and we'll have to go out and capture them. And it's kind of like doing our Steve Irwin imitation, you know, with crikey, and, you know, get him to a hospital, clean up wounds, things like that. So I that's not really my strong suit. I mean, I'm more of a northern animal guy, so I just do as told when out there. Because this is a dinosaur. I mean, alligators have not changed, you know, very much at all. And they have amazing abilities to heal themselves. And I really think there might even be a cure for cancer or something to help us in alligator blood. It is just loaded with nutrients.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive what they can do and their strength that they have. And as we were doing the same thing down at Colorado Gators, we were going in and basically pulling these alligators out and then checking them for wounds and then doing what we need to do in order to help those wounds as the other alligators fight each other. And it was just this experience that I had never had before, never was on my bucket list. And then one day I got a phone call And they said, hey, why don't you guys come down and we'll teach you guys how to wrestle alligators. And then you get to learn about the process of not just the wrestling part, but the whole process of why they're there and how they're helping these communities of alligators survive because people take them as pets when they shouldn't. So it was this huge education, and it was just this amazing insight to that whole world and such respect for them as animals and what they're doing now. It's, man, I'm glad I came back with all my digits.
Ah, and you know, we're really going to learn in the next 50 years, and the door is starting to open now, that intelligence shouldn't be measured by the size of a brain. Just the other day, I saw that there's a Siberian tiger in a zoo somewhere. And worst thing to do, to take a predator like that, that roams 100 miles, that has so much stimulus in that forest, and to just put him in a little sterile encampment. But evidently, he was not in a barred cage, because thank God those days are over with most zoos. But he was in an outdoor, you know, habitat enclosure, but certainly not big enough. And the Siberian tiger actually made a rudimentary snowman out of the snow that had fallen into his pen just to entertain himself. There was a bull elephant that we were studying in the Everglades. And this elephant is 60 years old. And he is so smart that he actually collects twigs and grasses, lays them across his nose, because a lot of alligators will eat birds. And he is so still in the water that he looks like a weathered log. So a bird comes down in the springtime and goes, oh, look, there's some nesting material. All that those twigs and grasses on this old log, I'm going to land on that log and I'm going to take the twigs away. Well, that's the last thing they know when they land on the log. So here's the bull alligator actually using twigs and grass as bait to catch a bird.
Never underestimate an alligator. So for you, you've done so many adventures. You have all these things that you've checked off during the course of your life. And I do want to go all the way back. In the beginning, you said you bumped into somebody that became the love of your life. Was that correct?
At that time. But like, you mean Genevieve when I ran into her in Colorado?
Yeah, but she did not stay because you ended up being this Cosmo bachelor.
Yeah, and the strangest thing was, is I didn't even want to do the Cosmopolitan thing. It was my first book. I wanted to be taken serious as a scientist. And I said to the publicist at HarperCollins, Janet, whenever I'm in a dentist office and for lack of anything to read, I pick up this magazine called Cosmo. And it, to me, it's the silliest thing about makeup and orgasms, you know, from the woman's point of view. I mean, it's just so over the top. And she said, Michael, look, you can't be a writer these days and live alone on an island or in a basement somewhere. You got to push books like they're boxes of soap. If Cosmo will mention your first book in that little blurb of you being the Bachelor of the Month, I mean, that is invaluable to you. But I fought it for the longest time. But, you know, I'm learning when opportunity knocks, don't judge the book by the cover. Sometimes that's the road you should go down. Because, long story short, there was a pot of gold at the end of all of those Cosmo girls. One day I got a letter that was so outstanding. It was almost like a job resume. It was all this woman's accomplishments. She was a Playboy bunny, lived at the mansion, flight attendant of the year, graduate of 7 chef schools, a chef on a corporate yacht in the Caribbean, like everything she had done. And, you know, just 35 years, so successful. And in between her words, she was saying, hey, buddy, I really don't need you. If you want strength meeting strength, call me up. And that's my wife to this day. So not only did Cosmo, you know, create so much learning from the other women, give me another book, but it brought me a life partner. And a lot of times guys will say, hey, man, why did you ever get married? You know, you could have dated all these women. And how do you even know when you're in love? And I like to tell people that you know you're in love when the other person's happiness is essential to your own. And I really feel that with Paula. When she's happy, then I'm happy.
Can you look back now and just see how interconnected everything has been for you?
Yeah, it's like, you know, you look back and you see the dots connecting. But at the time, maybe you don't want to go over there. You don't want to make that left turn. Like when I was thinking of going to live on the island, my father, who, you know, we want our parents' approval at every stage of our life, my dad did not speak to me for a year. And when I asked him why, he said, "You do not quit a job without having another one lined up. You're going to turn into a bum." I have a mother. She's Italian, full of Italian superstitions and visions. And she said, "Oh, Michael, don't go. My eye's twitching. It means death." Thank you, Mom. Thank you for your support. You know, but my mother is like, "Don't live, you might die." That's her whole attitude, you know.
I like so that attitude.
I went against my parents' wishes, you know, and my mother says, "Oh, I had a vision that a bear was eating you. You're going to die." And I'm going, "Oh, my God." But something told me, and it's the voice that has saved my life. If we have nine lives like a cat, I'm down to about two. And the voice comes from my solar plexus. It comes from the center of my body, not the top of my brain. It has saved my life more times than not. And it just told me I had to go live on that island, that high risk, high yield. Roll the dice and see what happens.
Well, looking back on your life now, some pretty phenomenal accomplishments. But for you, you've also got a future. What is something on your bucket list that you would still like to accomplish?
Well, we're getting very close to this, and this is going to open up a whole nother platform of communication. Is the woman who is my manager and also my publisher for the latest book, Wildlife, Corvallis Press, is getting very close to putting the book through as a movie. And everybody that reads the book is casting it like crazy. And I tried to write it very visually. It's almost like a screenplay as well as, you know, a book story as well. So I would really like to go in that direction. And, you know, this sounds crazy, but hey, that's my whole life, is I want to direct this movie. And, you know, I can just hear Hollywood say, "Oh, yeah, you've never directed a movie before in your life." Well, Sylvester Stallone never directed a movie, but look what he did with Rocky. You give me the DP, the director of photography, you know, some silver-haired old veteran that knows the camera angles and the lighting, I'm a storyteller. That's what I do for a living. I mean, whether we storyboard it, you know, shot by shot, but I want to make it a love letter to Alaska because Act One is in Alaska, Act Two is New York City for contrast and dating the women, and then Act Three, the girl he decides to marry, he takes back to Alaska. So, I mean, helicopter cam shots in Tracy Arm Fjord that we were talking about earlier with those waterfalls and hummingbirds and sapphire blue icebergs, big as houses, crashing around the two, the male and female leads in kayaks. I mean, it could be dazzling visually.
I love your vision. It's definitely going to happen. There's no doubt about it in my mind. And I'm going to go and I'm going to pay my $15 and I'm going to see that movie.
No. You're coming. If it does happen, you've got the red carpet for the opening.
Well, then I'll have to figure out who I'm going to bring. I like it. I like how you roll.
And maybe a cameo in the movie. Why not?
Yeah, why not? Well, you know, it's interesting. On my bucket list is to be in a movie. So this is something I wrote 5 years ago. And now just you just said it. And I'm like, I think I wrote that down. Yeah, I did. So here, this could be it. So I'm open.
We're gonna have some guy rappelling off a cliff in Tracy Arm Fjord, and it's going to be you, you know.
Down. I'm definitely down. Sign me up. This is great. I love how the universe works. So if people want to follow you, which I know they do, how would they do that?
To actually get the books, the best thing to do, because of my long last name, it's kind of hard to spell. If you just jump on Amazon and type in Wildlife, meaning, you know, the two separate words, and that'll take you to my four published books. And then I'm on Facebook and Twitter and my own website, you know, with Michael Modzelewski. If you try to spell, it'll probably spell correct and get you there anyway, you know. So I'd be honored if anybody paid a visit social media as well.
Well, We will also include this in the show notes and in the resources and references at the bottom of our show notes on thebucketlistlife.com if people want to reference it there.
Yeah, and come to Alaska. And you know what, Kenyon? I would be honored to be your personal guide if you guys ever wanted to come on a cruise.
Killer.
And a lot of times people go, oh, cruise, you just sit on a boat. Are you kidding me? We're in port every day. You can kayak, mountain climb. I mean, I will take you personally because I know you could handle it. One of my favorite secret places is to go into an ice cave underneath the glacier. There's a beautiful glacier in Juneau called Mendenhall. And you put on crampons, walk across the top of it, and then you drop down the side. And there's an entrance. And you go into this grotto of blue, bubble-like ice forms. And it's very dangerous because in the summertime, it's dripping on you because it's doing a lot of melting. And we always say, okay, we're setting our watch for 2 minutes. That's all we're going to give ourselves. 20 minutes later, you're a quarter mile in. Oh, I got to get this picture. But that light, that blue light, it just lights you up. It's so phenomenal inside the glacier. Not a lot of people can handle it, but I'm taking you in there if you come up.
Well, I'm absolutely on board with all the things and suggestions and offers that you've made me. And there's only one caveat to it. I will be happy to do all those things as long as you help me help at least one other person that so desires this and those things, and we help them make it happen. Are you down?
We'll take 10 people.
Love it. Love that idea. That's what the bucket list life is about. So in closing, what would you like to leave our listeners with? Some sort of takeaway or thought that they can really just sit with from today's conversation?
Well, I know you said it before. I know that you live it in your own life. And this is my sort of personal motto, is try to live each day that we have as your first in your last day upon this earth. And when you live at that first day with that fresh perspective, and you live at the last day as if this might be the last one you ever have, when you can put those two attitudes and visions together. But, you know, I think the worst part of human experience is to get to the end of the trail and to have any regrets that we didn't check off our bucket list, that we didn't go to places. Because I really believe, while we know we can't take material things with us, that I really believe that energy doesn't die, and I really believe that we take with us in an energy form our knowledge and everything that we've experienced in this lifetime. That's the true riches of this world.
Very wise and wonderful words. Thank you very much, Michael, for being on today's podcast.
Thank you, Kenyon. It's been an absolute honor to talk with somebody on this kind of a level. And this is one of the favorite shows that I've ever done in my whole life. And I take my hat off to you. You're a wonderful host.
I do accept that. Thank you very much. Very well appreciated. So that concludes episode 47 of The Bucket List Life. It's been a phenomenal one. It's been a journey where we've experienced so many things, the ups, the downs, the lefts and rights of how our life can lead us down and through paths that we don't expect. But when we look back, we have the opportunity to connect the dots and say, yeah, that's exactly how it's supposed to be and exactly what it was supposed to be. And again, if you'd like to follow Michael, you can see that in the show notes at thebucketlistlife.com. Click podcasts and you'll see the show notes there from all our other previous episodes and wonderful journeys and stories. So until next time, I want you to trust everything that you do, take every opportunity that you have and say yes, and live every moment that you have in the moment.
Bucket List Life, visit us at thebucketlistlife.com and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and YouTube.